All right. It's right around the corner, July 16th. My Broadway show's opening up. I hope you guys can make it. Permission to Speak with Paul Mercurio. It's a completely improvised show with the audience. If you see me do my stand-up, you see me do some of this, but it's a full theater show with a really cool set, and really excited, and hope you guys can make it and come support the show. And then if you do, my kid can get that rare blood transfusion that he needs. Okay, I'm pulling at heartstrings here, but you get the point. July 16th to August 15th at the Jerry Orbach Theater, and you go to my website, paulmercurio.com, and you use the code PMFAN. You click there, take you over to Ticketmaster, and you get some nice tickets at a 40% discount. So I hope you guys can make it. July 16th to August 15th, Permission to Speak with Paul Mercurio on Broadway. Had a great weekend. Here's a little riddle for you. What's pasty white, doesn't blink, and has no emotions? Me playing Data on Star Trek, The Next Generation. Yep. I went old school Comic-Con because of deepdiscount.com. Yep, they're my sponsor. Listen up. They support me. I need you to support them. If you can, please, they help me do this show for you. Deepdiscount.com has this really great sale on Comic-Con stuff. Everything from anime and animation to superheroes and TV shows like Star Trek The Next Generation. I went the whole weekend dressed as Data, and yes, my wife will never sleep with me again, but it was worth it. Go to my website, paulmercurio.com, click on the Deep Discount logo, and get great, great buys at deepdiscount.com on all sorts of stuff, including new releases out this week. A Quiet Place starring John Krasinski and Emily Blunt, doing their very best to be as quiet as possible so as to not be found by alien attackers who prey on the slightest of sound. Get this hit shocker of a horror for a great price at deepdiscount.com. A Quiet Place. I know what this is about. This is a game I play at home when my kid shows up with his friends. I go to my quiet place so they don't hear me and interact with me. Anyway, click on my logo on my homepage, on the Deep Discount logo on the homepage, paulmercurio.com, right there. Buy your favorites. Support my sponsor. Check it out. deepdiscount.com, and enjoy my guests this week, everybody. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the show. My guest this week is a world-renowned director and currently has a movie out called The Catcher Was a Spy, which is a terrific spy thriller starring Paul Rudd, the great Ben Lewin. Hi, Ben. Nice to have you on.
Hi. What an intro. Wow. I'm blushing already.
There you go. That's it. That's just the it's the whole interview. So thanks for being on. Please now.
best ever.
Yeah. And you know what? We got technology on your side now. You figured out how to use a speakerphone. I'm not trying, you know, which is a good thing. So, you know, they can be.
Yes. And tonight I'm learning how to turn on the TV. we don't know how to turn on the TV once the kids left home.
Jay Leno had a really funny joke. He gave his parents, this is a while ago, obviously, a VCR, and they, you know, he set it up for them. And then every time he came home, it would be plugged in, but blinking, you know, like when you unplug something and plug it back in, it just blinks like the time. Yeah. And he goes, "Mom, why every time I come home is this blinking?" She goes, "Well, we unplug it at night so it doesn't catch on fire." anyway, I want to talk about the movie and I want to talk about you. We have something in common. I'm an ex-lawyer and you're an ex-lawyer who ended up in the entertainment business. I did corporate law and I left to be a comedian, and you were a barrister in Australia. But always had an interest in photography and filmmaking. And where did that interest come from, and how did you make the transition out of law?
Well, I guess my first interest actually was in storytelling, which at school, when I was at elementary school, I started writing poems and stories, and that kind of fascinated me. Mm-hmm. And when I was about 11, this guy came to take my photo for some charity. You know, I was a child of the week for some Jewish charity. Mm-hmm. And I was totally fascinated by his camera. And it became, you know, a lifelong spell. It's strange. It's like that camera became such a symbolic thing to me. I had to have one. Mm-hmm. And my mother said, "Look, okay, if you come top of the class, I'll buy you a camera." So I thought, well, that's easy. I came top of the class. I got a camera, and she figured that she'd never have to bribe me anymore to come top the class. I could just do it if I wanted to.
Right.
And so that first camera was a kind of indelible mark of achievement. You know, I earned that. And it really became my companion for many years. I was absolutely dedicated to still photography.
What do you think it was about that camera? You know, I had Bob Costas on, and he talks about, you know, he's sports, big sports reporter, a host, and he talks about lying in bed when he was 10 years old listening to the St. Louis Cardinals games, and he was more enthralled with the announcing than he was the game. And so he pointed to that moment. And what was it for you as a kid that you think really drew you to the camera?
These things can't really be explained.
Yeah.
I guess I could sort of figure out how to connect the dots.
Right.
But I just call it serendipity.
Mm-hmm.
The man behind the camera was also a really good guy and he taught me photography. He became my first mentor, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
And that had something to do with it as well.
Interesting.
And I think the very first time that I actually developed a picture under the blanket on the kitchen table, you know, developed a paper print.
Wow.
I mean, that was unforgettable.
Yeah.
From a blank white piece of paper comes a picture. I mean, that's nothing remarkable nowadays, but that to me as a kid was pure magic.
Yeah.
So that was also one of those memorable head-turning events, if you like.
It's funny, if you look back, you can then see why you are where you are today. I mean, for me, I loved watching comedians on The Tonight Show, and I don't know why, but I would just beg my parents to stay up late when there was a comedian. And then I went on to do a career that was a traditional career, but I obviously, in looking back, there was something inside of me and inside of you with regard to filmmaking that was just sort of, I guess, in our DNA, you know?
Well, I wouldn't have minded being a comedian too. I would have liked being, you know, the world's first sit-down comic. I think that would have worked for me.
Yeah.
But I don't find any kind of logic in what happened to me.
Yeah.
You know, to take me from one place to another.
Mm.
In a sort of a broad sense, I just went where the river took me.
Yeah.
You know, I kind of grew up in an era of tremendous self-confidence,
mm-hmm.
that you could do anything.
Mm.
And I guess that once I was a lawyer and I said, okay, well, I've done the lawyer thing. Now I can do anything I want.
Mm. Interesting.
Maybe like you, you know,
the
lawyer was a kind of a rite of passage to prove that you could be a normal person if you wanted to be.
Yeah. Although I know a lot of abnormal.
Like Mo Berg, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's a lot of parallel, and I know a lot of abnormal lawyers. So, but there's a,
when I moved from law into film, it was really just moving from one branch of show business into another.
Exactly.
I mean, I was a trial lawyer.
Oh, wow.
And it was really very theatrical.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the sort of performances that I would not allow on screen.
If you were directing yourself, you would fire yourself from that trial.
Absolutely,
huh?
I would squash it.
That's so funny. Do you were you doing filmmaking? Like, I started to do stand up on the side while I was still working as a lawyer and a banker. Were you doing the same with filmmaking? Were you sort of dabbling in it as a hobby?
No. It was absolutely accidental. You know, I was practicing law, and a friend of mine from university that I'd started the photography club with said, oh, look, I've enrolled you in a summer school in filmmaking. And it was just for a joke. And then, you know, I incidentally got involved in the beginnings of the film bureaucracy in Australia.
Uh-huh. What is the film bureaucracy? What does that mean?
Well, the Australian film industry is basically government supported.
Ah, okay.
As the Canadian film industry and a lot of the European film industry.
Mm-hmm.
And that was at a time in the early 70s when they were creating the infrastructure, you know, like a film bank and a film school and
just, right.
you know, the essential elements of the national film industry,
right.
which we felt we deserved at that time. Mm-hmm. And I kind of got involved in that politically because I was a lawyer with a sort of metaphorical half-finished novel in the bottom drawer. You know, mm-hmm. I was known as that kind of lawyer involved in the arts. And so they wanted me to be, you know, a bureaucrat. And then that somehow didn't happen. I got sidelined. I was supposed to get a job, and instead of me, it was the son of the Supreme Court judge. And I thought, oh, well, yes, that's a superior qualification.
or a better connection. That's all. more well-connected.
Yeah, well, it was an early lesson in the way life really
is. Yeah, exactly.
and so the people, the political people who had engineered this felt very embarrassed. And somehow they offered me a kind of consolation prize, mm-hmm. a scholarship to a film school in England. And I thought, wow, yeah, I'll go for that. I mean, I was ready for it. You know, I was a young bachelor and I could do it. And I thought, why not? You know, mm-hmm. so Friday I was in court with a wig and gown, and Monday I was at film school in England.
Yeah, that's great. Wow, that's incredible.
Great. It was really the three best years of my life.
So, you know, you're making film, you made some great films, and what was it Ketcher was a spy. I'm a big fan of Paul Rudd, and it's great how he's transitioned out of comedy, so to speak, and can do these roles now. But he said something interesting about the movie in an interview that I read. He said it's more of a cerebral spy movie, not necessarily just about action. It's about the thinking part of this character, Mo Berg, and I felt that was accurate. Obviously, that was intentional. What sort of drew you to take that approach to the film?
Well, it was really a kind of a balancing act because that was a challenge to combine a character study with a mission movie, if you like. Mm-hmm. And the two are not necessarily a natural mix.
Right.
But there was no other way to go. I mean, the movie was always going to be a balancing act between a character study and a mission movie. Mm-hmm. That was in the very nature of Mo's life. It was in the nature of the book that Nicky Davidoff wrote. And there was really no other way to go, even though it was a kind of danger zone. It was the thing we had to struggle with, you know, throughout.
Did you get pressure from the studio, you know, because I mean, Hollywood's really focused on action movies all the time, pretty much all the time now. Did you get pressure from them to sort of put more action in it?
Well, this wasn't a studio movie. This is an indie movie.
Right. Distributors or, you know, whoever's selling it. I assume you did not.
No, yeah. I didn't get the pressure. The pressure came from me.
Ah, okay.
I mean, I wanted to put more action in it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because I wanted to get a sense that, not just gratuitously, but I wanted to get the sense that Mo Berg was out there, with the advance units of the Fifth Army, actually in the line of fire, you know, trying to get to scientists before the Germans did or before they escaped. And I wanted to get the sense that, you know, he wasn't just lurking around dark streets, mm-hmm. but that, you know, he was in the middle of all this shit.
Yeah.
And I guess because he was such a scholar by nature and not a military type or an assassin, I thought it's just so anachronistic for him to be in the middle of this, but he was.
Yeah.
And one of the things I liked about Mo was that, you know, he seemed to be quite fearless or oblivious to danger in some ways.
And did you, for people who have yet to see the film, I mean, by the way, I grew up in New England, so I'm a huge Red Sox fan. So I was blown away when I saw the part of the movie.
Fenway Park?
Yeah. I was so excited to see it. Beautiful park, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, my God, it's like going to a religious place.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
We had people buzzing us around us saying, now, don't put your foot where the gravel meets the grass.
Yeah, I know.
And really, you know, we're tiptoeing around there like we're in the middle of an operating room.
I never heard it put that way.
Everything is so immaculate.
Yeah.
They were very hospitable.
Yeah, that's great. What is give people a synopsis of the movie and Mo. I mean, Mo's this fascinating guy. He went to Princeton, played in Major League Baseball, coached in Major League Baseball, and then transitioned into being a spy. Fill that out a little bit for folks, if you don't mind.
Well, I think that Mo spent his entire life trying to avoid conformity of any sort.
Mm-hmm.
And from the very beginning, he went where he didn't belong, you know, the first place being Princeton, which at that time, you know, Jews were really not the thing at Princeton. Mm-hmm. And a Jewish baseball player was the next thing he wasn't supposed to be. But somehow it suited the game. You know, he really reveled in this kind of professor label that he had, and it attracted a lot of attention. So here was a mediocre player attracting a lot of attention to the game because of the kind of character he was.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think being Jewish at that time turned out to be a bit of an advantage because they were, I think, trying to attract Jewish fans. And we were looking at the end of his baseball career and him trying to figure out what he would want to do next, not to conform. Now, you know, there's a certain amount of debate as to whether his Japanese adventure, you know, where he filmed the naval installations in Tokyo Harbor, whether he was freelancing or already a spy of sorts. And in my opinion, he was freelancing, which makes it all the more peculiar, you know, that he didn't get a job as a spy first.
Right. Was there any indication in his background that he'd be interested in doing something like that? That sounds so obviously unique and outside the box, you know.
Well, only his interest in the world.
Yeah,
I mean, he was a very outward-looking guy. Mm-hmm. He was a modern man par excellence at a time, I guess, when America was very insular, and he spoke upwards of a dozen languages. Read all the international newspapers all the time. He read newspapers in multiple languages and had an acute sense of what was going on in the world. And I think that he saw, you know, the war with Japan, certainly. He saw that war coming probably long before most people did. And I think, yes, there was, you know, his nature, scholarly nature, if you like, and his curiosity probably put him in a place which was unique.
How did he go from, you know, when his baseball career was over, Nelson Rockefeller gave him a job with the Office of Inter-American Affairs that allowed him to travel through South and Central America studying health and fitness, and which then led to the OSS. But how did that relationship with Rockefeller come about, and how did that appointment come about?
I think that probably came through his Princeton connections. Because by that time, you know, Mo was already a public figure. So he could have access to people, you know, at a level. I mean, there are stories that he, you know, interacted with Einstein. You know, I don't know whether that's absolutely true. I mean, Mo was also a storyteller in his own right, and you don't know quite the accuracy of some of his stories, but there is a fabled encounter between him and Albert Einstein where they offered to sort of swap knowledge. You know, you tell me relativity and I'll tell you baseball. And Einstein turned him down on the basis that baseball was too hard to learn.
Well, there you go, right there. A lot of people would attest to that.
So Mo was a celebrity in his own time.
Yeah.
But I think the Rockefeller connection was probably, you know, a Princeton thing as well.
Well, that's what I love about the film is that it sort of opens your eyes to someone who's utterly fascinating, clearly a worldly gentleman, and someone that I wouldn't otherwise really know about to reading, you know, history books. Obviously, I'm sure he's there, but it's almost in a way a documentary and entertainment in one, which is not easy to achieve. And I thought that that was really one of the great things about it, because I love, and in the context of World War II, and then layering in this sort of, you know, his Jewish religion and sort of all of that, and the complexities that comes with in that era. I thought you really packaged it nicely.
Oh, thank you. Well, I have a background in documentary. I mean, I love mixing the two. I mean, the first thing I learned in making documentaries was treat it like fiction. You know, you find an interesting character and go on a journey with that character.
Right.
And you know, I often felt documentaries are just like making movies without paying the actors.
That's exactly right. You have a great cast: Paul Giamatti, Jeff Daniels, Paul Rudd. Really terrific group of actors. Was there a commonality in working with them in terms of how you had to approach directing them, or was sort of each one handled differently?
Well, you have to handle every person differently, but you know, there's a point where everyone on a movie has to be a team player.
Right.
They're so experienced, these guys. That part of it is easy, but every one of them is completely individual. I mean, my relationship with Paul Rudd was totally different from my relationship with Paul Giamatti.
Mm-hmm.
Both incredibly affable and jokey, but in a very different way.
Right.
I mean, Tom Wilkinson was very funny to work with because, you know, he has this kind of grumpy quality about it, but it's all piss and wind. He's really a softie.
Oh, really?
You know, I'd say, Tom, you need to follow him out of the room. Why? Well, because you don't want him to leave. Oh, okay. he'd always question it. And I remember there was one moment, you know, when I learned that we got Tom Wilkinson, everyone had forgotten to ask him whether he spoke German, because a lot of that scene, he was supposed to be speaking German.
Right.
So I called him and said, Tom, how's your German? German? And I thought, okay, better put a lid on this. Oh, don't worry about that. All right. I didn't say anything.
So, you almost blew it.
Who cares what language they speak?
Yeah.
They speak English, that's fine.
Yeah, he's a tremendous actor.
And the very first take, you know, my wife, who was also one of the producers, came over to me, and she never usually does that. You know, she doesn't mess with me in the middle of a scene.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, you know, his accent stands out like a sore thumb. It's so English.
Mm.
So absolutely pucker Oxford English. And we haven't got any accents like that in the movie, which was true.
Mm-hmm.
And so, okay, I go to Tom, can you do accents? What accent do you want? Oh, Hungarian? No. So I said, well, any accent then. Okay. So, you know, he puts on this kind of completely indeterminate accent.
Right.
Could belong anywhere, but it works.
Oh, my God. You know? Yeah, it does. I mean,
So there was a way of working with Tom where, you'd absolutely get what you needed out of him. But it was a kind of a process. You know, you'd have to debate the issue a little bit.
Right.
But every one of them is very, you know, questioning. They really get into their characters and what, you know, what motivates every move and every manner, and they put you on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
When it's not absolutely clear, and I mean that's part of the fun of it, really. I used to have a very different attitude to actors. I used to be very controlling.
Mm-hmm.
And want to know what they were going to do. Now I don't want to know what they're going to do. Just do it.
We'll
play with it.
Did you rehearse at all?
No, I don't rehearse.
And what was the turning point for you from going from being controlling to less controlling with your actors?
You know, I think the sessions was a turning point for me in that way. In that I hadn't made a film for a while. I felt very down. I thought I've got to do something just for my own dignity and sense of self-worth.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought one of the things I'm going to try and do is enjoy the process. You know, directors are very result-oriented.
Right.
Nothing matters except, you know, that light at the end of the tunnel or whatever you call it,
right.
Gold. And I thought, no, damn it, I'm going to try and enjoy the process so that becomes an end in itself.
Hmm.
And to me, you know, I thought, wow, I have this treasure chest of wonderful actors. Just let them do their thing, see what happens. And also the digital age had caught up with us.
Right.
And you weren't firing real bullets anymore, you know, when you turned the camera on. It was just, I don't know what it is, electricity, shit like that going on.
Explain to people what you mean by you weren't firing real bullets, meaning you're not worried about spending money on film and all of that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. I mean, you would, in the old days, you'd rehearse the hell out of it because, you know, that plastic with the perforations on the side costs real money.
Right.
every time you turned on the camera. And nowadays it doesn't cost any more money to turn on the camera than not to turn on the camera.
Right.
So I thought, wow, I mean, why rehearse?
Right.
See what happens.
Right.
And I think, you know, particularly in the sessions where I felt I wanted to make it seem to some extent like a documentary.
Mm.
I think that I found not too late, I hope, a really renewed respect for what actors could bring independent of the director.
Mm-hmm. What are those things that they bring that you, this time around with sessions, you know, kind of really impress you?
Well, you know, a sense of the character that I didn't need to force on them.
Right.
That they brought, you know, with their preparation and their instincts about what the script meant and who the character was. I mean, it's as simple as that.
Right.
You know, let them own the character and don't be the puppet master.
Right. Right. What was it about Paul Rudd? What was it about Paul Rudd that, drew you to him for the lead in this? I thought it was a really good choice, but, was there anything in particular?
A whole lot of things. I guess one of the things was that, oh, it's an unlikely choice.
Yes.
It's not his genre.
Mm.
And I thought, well, that fits. I mean, he's playing a man that did a whole lot of unlikely things. I don't know. I just felt that the, I've always admired comic actors who don't strain to be funny. I mean, Paul always felt like a very, very natural comic to me.
Right.
And Mo Berg was an elusive character, often, I think, very remote and not accessible. And I thought, that's not what you want in a movie. In a movie, you want a relatable character, one that the audiences can see. Yes, I may not totally understand the guy, but I can empathize with him.
Right.
And I think that Paul brings a kind of ordinary authenticity to things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he brings all the acting disciplines, but he manages to make it look like it's just a person, you know. It's just not an actor.
Yeah, the other person that's really good at that is Jason Bateman, who had in the movie Hancock, where, you know, I don't know if you saw it, but it's actually a really good movie, I think. Will Smith plays this sort of washed up superhero who's an alcoholic, and Jason has to be sort of it's slightly comedic at times, but it's mainly a drama. light drama, and he really walks that line well, the way Paul does.
Yeah, and you know, well, I haven't seen that, but that's interesting. Jason Bateman is certainly someone I admire enormously.
Yeah.
But you know, one of the other things about Paul is that, you know, this is part of an evolving relationship, and at a certain point you realize, okay, between the director and the lead actor, this is going to be a partnership,
mm-hmm.
and you better feel comfortable as partners. In other words, as a sense of commitment that you're in the same struggle together.
Right.
I know that sounds a bit cheesy, but it is a bit of a war zone making a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to feel that the other, you know, conspicuously main person in the show is on your side, is your comrade.
Mm. Yeah, and that has to start early on, obviously.
It has to start early on, and it has to, you know, sustain itself. Mm. And you know, you have to have this kind of Three Musketeers thing. Well, there were two of us. No, there were three of them, weren't there? That, I liked that Three Musketeers
there you
stuff
go.
That those guys did yeah. together. Didn't you? I mean, we didn't know that in advance, but when you put the three of them together, there was a real kind of beautiful music out of it.
Man, that's great. That is really great. Well, the movie is in theaters now. And this is Ben Lewin, the director. It's called The Catcher Was a Spy. It's really, you know, and I was thinking too, just they've been doing this with the James Bond films where they're trying to give the character more depth. You know, obviously those are big action movies, but I really think that I really like your movie because it sort of isn't just bang, bang, bang. There's a little, some of that, but there's really, you really sort of get a sense of these characters, and it's really terrific. And I encourage people to go see it. It's in theaters now. Thank you for being on. You were great.
Hey, that was a great pleasure. And as I say, I'm so flattered to join your rogues gallery. I get my little thumbnail up on your website.
Oh, you will. I'm going to put you up. Look, I want your wife to take a picture of you trying to figure out how to operate your phone. And that's the picture I want to use.
Okay. Right. Well, from one lapsed lawyer to another, that was a real pleasure.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Great to have you on.
All right. How was that? Ben Lewin. Very cool. Cool movie. Hope you guys check out my Broadway show, July 16th, starting at the Jerry Orbach Theater. Go to my website for tickets, paulmercurio.com. Click right there on the homepage and use the code PMFAN to get a discount. All right. See you guys next week.